The journalist Juan Williams is out with a new book. In it, he makes the case that his firing last fall by NPR was part of a pattern of suppressing unwelcome opinions by the network. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik recently sat down with Juan Williams, and he has this report.
The overall theme of the book, Muzzled, is that reasonable people are being shut up and shut down. Today's media landscape, Juan Williams says, feels like a New York City street.
You hear the cabs honking and the kids screaming and the ice cream truck with its melodies. You can hear everything out here. And I think to myself, but David, I think the experience most Americans have is that they bite their tongue on a regular basis.
The first chapter of Muzzled focuses on Williams' firing as a senior news analyst at NPR, which he says exemplifies the pressure on people throughout society to censor themselves. In his case, Williams blames what he says is a small group of elitist liberal news executives who didn't like when he expressed his opinions in other news outlets, including the Fox News Channel.
I think that what was behind it in the mind of the executive that fired me was my willingness to work for Fox and to engage conservatives and to stand up and make arguments that oftentimes were construed as conservative arguments, whether it was on Fox or in print or in books.
In Muzzled, Williams writes that editors were unhappy with his previous book, Enough, in which he criticized liberal black leaders. Williams, himself black, says he was told by an NPR executive whom he would not identify that he was not in sync with the kind of African Americans valued by the network. Yet NPR's Morning Edition devoted 7.5 minutes to an interview with Williams about Enough and used it to kick off a week of stories about leadership among African Americans.
NPR is a stunningly open-minded place.
Margaret Lowe Smith is NPR's acting senior vice president for news.
We're deeply appreciative and, in fact, encouraging of different points of view. Everybody knows that we apply journalistic rigor to absolutely every story we tell. We challenge our own. We challenge each other's assumptions every day in the way we report the news and the way we lead this organization.
NPR officials terminated Williams' contract last October. Fox's Bill O'Reilly asked him what was wrong with saying Muslims killed us on 9/11. Williams said not to worry.
I mean, look, Bill, I'm not a bigot. You know, the kind of books I've written about the civil rights movement in this country. But when I get on a plane, I got to tell you, if I see people who are in Muslim garb, and I think, you know, they're identifying themselves first and foremost as Muslims, I get worried. I get nervous.
A minute later, Williams circled back, telling O'Reilly it was important to distinguish between a terrorist and a faith, saying Americans did not blame Christians for Timothy McVeigh's deadly attack in Oklahoma City. But critics said Williams was encouraging racial profiling. Ellen Weiss, then NPR's senior vice president for news, called Williams to cut his contract short. The ensuing outcry from journalists and conservative lawmakers cost Weiss her job and helped fuel the later departure of CEO Vivian Schiller in March. These days, no one at NPR defends how Williams was fired. Williams writes of his fears for his career and wrote he was concerned he'd be considered bigoted. He found widespread sympathy from journalists, including Clarence Page, a Pulitzer-winning columnist for the Chicago Tribune. But Page also notes Williams' 2-book deal, his newspaper column, and his 3-year contract with Fox News, worth a reported $2 million.
I have a hard time seeing Juan as being muzzled. I have no quarrel with NPR or Fox News deciding what's going to go out over their air and who the people are going to be who are going to put that stuff out over the air.
The media critic William McGowan is author of the book Gray Lady Down, which contends the New York Times is compromised by liberal bias. He thinks NPR leans to the left and should have leapt at a chance for its journalists to appear on Fox shows with conservative hosts.
I listen to it at a discount, but it's got a lot to offer. It is not the great Satan that the right wing on Capitol Hill made it out to be.
Williams' central contention that people are muzzled occurs amid the presence of cable channels and websites feeding almost every ideology or interest, and the ability of non-journalists to find audiences on Twitter or Tumblr. He says ordinary people in the sensible center get steamrolled, yet he says he's a fan of Fox's high decibel approach.
I think that you've got to have strong personality, strong points of view, in order to succeed in this media landscape.
That's a central conflict. Margaret Lowe Smith says NPR wants to draw clear lines between opinion, that is beliefs, and analysis, providing context and insights. This week, Williams has been making the rounds to make his case about his beliefs and to promote Muzzled in print interviews, on Fox News, on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, on NPR's Diane Rehm Show, and on other public radio programs. David Folkenflik, NPR News, New York.
The Prime Minister of Norway said today that an independent commission will investigate the attacks last Friday that killed at least 76 people. Jens Stoltenberg also said his country's open and tolerant society will not be intimidated by such violence. But there is concern that authorities failed to recognize the threat from far-right extremists. NPR's Sylvia Pajoli reports on one group that has long documented the rise of hate groups in Norway, the country's top crime writers.
5 days after the bomb blast at the government district and killing spree at a youth camp, Norway is still gripped in a mood of collective sorrow. Addressing the media today, Prime Minister Stoltenberg vowed that his country will fight back with more democracy and will not bow to panic and fear. But he acknowledged that following the attacks, a different Norway will emerge.
But I hope, and I also believe, that the Norway we'll see after will be a more open, more tolerant society than Norway we had before.
Norway is one of the world's richest countries, has virtually no unemployment, and enjoys one of the most generous welfare systems. But Friday's attacks have ripped off the veneer and revealed the existence of a tormented and divided society beneath the surface. Politicians have been taken by surprise. Not so crime writer Ann Holt, who has been tracking right-wing extremism on the web for years. Her last book, Fear Not, is about the increasingly strident public debate and rising hate crime.
The relation between spoken violence on one hand and actual violence on the other. After the last day's events in Norway, the question is more relevant than ever.
Holt is a former police official, a former justice minister, and currently one of Norway's best-selling writers of detective fiction. She belongs to what's called the Scandinavian crime fiction renaissance, said to have taken off after the 1986 murder of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme. As yet unsolved, that assassination raised many questions about wealthy, complacent welfare state societies unwilling to question themselves and their occasionally ambiguous past. In Sweden and Norway in particular, crime writers have picked up the torch of the 19th century social novel. They are exploring the undercurrents that Holt recognizes in Norway, a society undergoing great social changes, including growing racism and discrimination against new immigrants, as well as a rise in anti-Semitism and homophobia. Holt says politicians would do well to read crime fiction.
I would really claim that it's the best genre to reflect society. Crime fiction is a mirror.
A mirror that reflects what a society is afraid of.
And what people are afraid of says a lot about society.
In low crime rate Norway, Holt says, people are most afraid of deranged murderers and hate crime. Anders Breivik fits that crime fiction profile to a T. He represents a new kind of radical right, well-educated, fluent in foreign languages, and thanks to the web, he doesn't have to reveal himself and risk meeting potential co-conspirators in public.
That this guy was absolute impossible to get into the radar because of the fact that he has been a law-obeying citizen for all his life. He is 32 years old, and he has some traffic tickets.
Holt is convinced a society cannot protect itself from a Breivik through surveillance and increased security.
The only way that we can prevent this from happening in the future is to turn the mirror, look at ourselves, and see what the hell happened. This boy is born in the best and richest country in the world. He has had every single chance of being a happy, perfectly adjusted human being. But something went terribly wrong. And we have to ask ourselves why.
Norway's image as a caring, loving society, the crime writer says, is only half true. And the country must now brace itself and try to deal with its darker, less tolerant side. Sylvia Poggioli, NPR News, Oslo.
In the spirit of Comic-Con, we have a recommendation now of three books all about superheroes. Here's Matt Johnson.
The words comic books and superheroes were synonymous at one time in America. But in the years since Art Spiegelman's Mouse won the Pulitzer Prize, graphic storytelling as a medium has grown up. Superheroes, for their part, have flown away as well, off the colored page and on to Hollywood, where they now dominate our summer blockbuster fair. And while this summer's lukewarm reactions to some of these films may show that the allure of Mystery Men has faded in the eyes of the public, on the pages of these three novels, superheroes still shine in technicolor. Literary and genre fiction are often married, but seldom is it a happy relationship, with the offspring inheriting all of literary's drabness with none of genre's allure. Not so with Jonathan Lethem's Men in Cartoons, which manages to incorporate the best of both worlds into something truly unique and haunting. One of the most powerful superhero tales I've read in any medium is in the story Super Goat Man, where a fated hero is hired as the distinguished Walt Whitman Chair at the narrator's liberal arts college. The story combines the failures of both comic book lore and the baby boomers to live up to Generation X's childhood expectations. George R.R. Martin may be best known for his medieval fantasy series, A Song of Ice and Fire, but before turning to swords and dragons, Martin created an equally complex and vast superhero world with his Wildcard series, a collaborative work of linked stories that Martin edited as well as contributed to. Wildcards is the tale of a world where a biological attack results in much of the population being transformed into either aces, those with stunning superpowers, or jokers, those changed into hideous monstrosities, if they survive at all. This intricate, haunting world has grown to encompass 21 books in the 24 years since the first volume was published. Austin Grossman's Justice League of America-inspired reality in Soon I Will Be Invincible feels so alive, you can almost see the muscles rippling through the page. The reader is immersed in the future promised to us by Saturday morning cartoons. I would call it a satire, but there is too much love here of the superhero mythos for the story to unravel into cynical absurdity. In the last decades, we have learned that comic books are not a genre, but a medium capable of telling any story. From these novels, we can see that the superhero genre itself can be just as sophisticated, allowing us to once again feel the bliss of when you were just back from the comic book shop, with all your glossy treasures splayed across the floor.
That's author Matt Johnson with the latest in our series, Three Books, in which authors recommend three books on one theme. His latest book is called Pym. For all of our summer reading picks, you can visit our summer books page at npr.org.
Our program is directed by Greg Dixon, edited by Corey Turner and Allison McAdam, and produced by Franklin Cater. The technical director is Stu Rushfield. The engineering supervisor is Robert Jackson.
The National Desk staff includes Uri Berliner, Cindy Johnston, Russell Lewis, Vicki Walton-James, Bruce Oster, and Jason DeRose.
The managing editor for NPR News is David Sweeney. Our executive producer is Christopher Turpin. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, has a review of Dana Spiota's new novel. Her 2006 novel, Eat the Document, was nominated for a National Book Award. It explores the life of a middle-aged mother who had been a member of a weatherman-type anti-war group in the 70s. Spiota's new novel, Stone Arabia, also investigates the long-time costs of passionate commitment.
One summer when I was in high school, I took a fiction writing course at the New School in New York. The most valuable thing I learned there was the golden rule of creative writing: don't quit your day job. Of course, lots of writers, as well as artists and musicians, ignore that practical wisdom. They gamble all on their artistic visions. We applaud the Patti Smiths and Robert Mapplethorpes, the Emily Dickinsons and John Kennedy Tools who forge ahead, because their belief in their own gifts has been validated by history. But what about those other folks you never hear about, the ones who don't make it, the no-hit wonders, the roadkill, as Dana Spiota sadly refers to them in her latest novel? Should we admire them too? Or are artists and writers who lose themselves in their art yet never find an audience merely losers? That's a big question at the center of Spiota's smart new novel, Stone Arabia. Critics often use adjectives like smart, brilliant, and intelligent to refer to Spiota's work because she tackles philosophical subjects in an edgy, collage-type style that jumbles together time frames and narrative modes. She even throws around words like ontological. If all that sounds off-putting, be assured that Spiota's novels are postmodern without the chill. Character development and the spiky nuances of family relationships are always a central concern. As much as we're invited in Stone Arabia to meditate on the value of the art of Nick Worth, the aging non-starter rock and roller who's one of the main characters here, we're also caught up in the emotional toll his obsessions exact on his sister, Denise. There's almost always a Denise in the life of an art for art's sake artist, the mother, partner, or family member who's grounded enough to worry, the one who somehow comes up with the money for rent and food. Denise has been Nick's number one fan, and largely his only one, since they were teenagers. Nick is a guitarist-songwriter who's played in a few bands and almost got a record deal decades ago. Now, closing in on 50, he bartends part-time and lives on food stamps, and as Denise puts it, has generally pursued a lifetime of abuse that could only come from a warped relationship with the future. The thing that really makes Nick special is his music, which is akin to that fabled tree in the forest that falls and no one hears. Nick has documented his career, or is it a career, in his other life's work, something he calls the Chronicles. The Chronicles are 30 or so volumes that stretch from 1978 to 2004 and document Nick's music, including reviews, all of which Nick has written himself just for the Chronicles under many different aliases. Here's a brief section from Denise's pages-long description of how the Chronicles work. Nick's Chronicles adhered to the facts and then didn't. When Nick's dog died in real life, his dog died in the Chronicles. But in the Chronicles, he got a big funeral and a tribute album. Fans sent thousands of condolence cards. But it wasn't always clear what was conjured. The music for the tribute album for the dog actually exists, as does the cover art for it. But the fan letters didn't exist. In this way, Nick chronicled his years in minute but twisted detail. You could imagine someone discovering the Chronicles 100 years from now and heralding Nick as some outsider artist's genius. Or, just as plausibly, you could consider the Chronicles as a testament to a wasted life, the work of a troubled mind, or both. Stone Arabia evades answers and instead encourages an open-minded blurring of the lines between lived experience and fantasy, art which is authorized versus art which is unvetted. This is a powerful novel about responsibility, the responsibility artists have to their art, the responsibility family members have to take care of each other. Its only flaw, and I would be irresponsible if I didn't mention it, is its ending, which feels at once improbable and weak. But overall, Stone Arabia should make its readers grateful that Dana Spiota herself isn't one of those outsider, unpublished visionaries whose life she imagines here with such compassion and verve.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Stone Arabia by Dana Spiota. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews Blake Shelton's new album. Shelton has expanded his audience through his role as a judge on the NBC singing competition, The Voice.
My next guest says he's created something groundbreaking in the world of poetry. Brian McGagan calls it broetry, poetry for bros. Here's how he describes it.
Broetry originated centuries ago high atop the mountains of feudal Japan, when a small sect of samurai monks decided they were tired of writing poems that were deep and meaningful and opted instead to write something people might actually enjoy. Okay, I made all that up. Broetry is poetry for dudes. It's poetry for people who don't like poetry. Had a rough day, feel like sitting down and relaxing, but only have a few minutes before the girlfriend gets back from Pilates? Broetry. Broetry is poetry for the 21st century. Broetry speaks to every man, woman, and dude child who understands that reading shouldn't have to be a chore. If you think you don't like poetry, you just haven't found a poem that's right for you. Broetry is poetry that's right for you. Broetry is a literary chili cheeseburger.
Brian McGagan calls himself America's Broet Laureate. He's got a master's in poetry from USC, and to everyone's surprise, he's the first in his class to land a book deal. And that book? It's a collection of broems, poems for bros, called Broetry. We asked him to share a few of them, starting with a haiku, Why Do Buses Smell?
Why do buses smell? The young girl asks her mother. I listen, because I want to know too. He's in Miami. This is probably the only completely true broem in the book. Every word of this is true. He's in Miami. Just in case the Los Angeles Police Department is looking for information on the whereabouts of a crafty-looking Latino male, age 30, about 5'10", and extremely skinny, who likes to smoke pot a lot and play video games all day, and who enjoys drinking Newcastle, Guinness, and high quantities of vitamin water, in the interest of any ongoing drug-related crimes in the area, for example, illegal possession, illegal sale, or illegal production in his friend's apartment in Los Feliz, he's in Miami. If you manage to track him down, please let me know. He owes me rent, 2 bottles of Arizona green tea, and a frozen pizza. Supreme, please.
Are there any sort of like broetic forebears, you know, in the world of broetry?
Yeah, there are a lot of poets who had broetic qualities. Frost liked baseball. He wrote about sports. His poetry was always very accessible. Even Shakespeare. Shakespeare was just writing about chicks. The cover poem is certainly an homage to William Carlos Williams.
The one on the cover of the book.
Yeah, the cover reads, I have finished the beer that was in the icebox and which you were probably saving for Friday. Forgive me, this girl came over, so sweet and so hot. Why you should listen to classical music. Two words, John Williams. Jaws, Superman, Indiana Jones. When Darth Maul gets chopped in half, spoiler alert, Obi-Wan is grooving to some classical music. I know what you're thinking, though. That movie came out in 1999. That's not classical music. First, Do you know what a leitmotif is? Second, Little Johnny Love is like 80 years old. Classical music. Did you know he composed the music for 4 separate Olympic Games and the theme song to Lost in Space? It's ridiculous. Classical music. It makes you smarter. And admit it, you could be more cultured. You just picked up a book called Broetry.
That's America's Broet Laureate, Brian McGack, and his new book of Broems, Poems for Bros, is called Broetry. Brian, thanks, bro.
Thank you.
Now, here's a book I wish I could have written. It's called Nothing Daunted, The Unexpected Education of 2 Society Girls in the West. It's written by Dorothy Wickenden, who first wrote a version of the story for The New Yorker, where she's the executive editor. The book is about her grandmother Woodruff, also named Dorothy. Dorothy Woodruff and her best friend forever, Rosamond Underwood, grew up together in Auburn, New York, in very comfortable upper-middle-class circumstances. They were best friends from kindergarten. They went to Smith College together. They went on the European tour, which was a coming-of-age ritual for girls of their class. But somehow, 7 years after graduation, Dorothy and Rosamond remained unmarried and longing for adventure. Dorothy Wickenden tells the story of the adventure they found, which changed their lives. She joins us from NPR West to talk about the book. Dorothy Wickenden, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Linda.
Did you know your grandmother, Dorothy?
I did. I knew her very well. She'd come to visit us a couple of times a year, and we'd go to visit her a couple of times a year. And every time we did, my brothers and I would make her sit down and tell us this story about the year in Colorado. So I remembered it very well.
Their adventure began when a young woman from Wellesley College, Emily Calloway, had an introduction to meet Rosamond. They had tea, and they began to talk about how difficult it was for young women to find meaningful work. Now, this, of course, is the beginning of the 20th century. This is the sort of the launch of their adventure. Could you read from the middle of page 81?
Calloway mentioned that just that day she had heard from a Wellesley friend, Ruth Carpenter Woodley, who had an adventuresome brother named Ferry Carpenter. She described his background and told Ros and Dorothy that he had worked with his neighbors for 5 years to build a consolidated schoolhouse in the Elkhead Mountain Range. Her brother was a man of vision, Ruth wrote to Emily, and he had asked her to look around New York for 2 young female college graduates who would consider teaching out there for a year or two. Mrs. Underwood knew that Rosamond felt constricted in her life at home, and as Calloway spoke, she saw her daughter's animated response. She was not surprised to hear Ros say, "I'd like to try it myself if my best friend and classmate from Smith, Dorothy Woodruff, would go with me."
So Ferry Carpenter brings them out to the Elkhead Mountains on the western slope of Colorado, a little community which is called, it's called Elkhead, isn't it?
It is, still.
The Syracuse paper reported, "Society girls go to the wilds of Colorado."
Yes, they did. And their parents were shocked and almost didn't allow them to go, even though they were 29 years old. And Rosamond's mother said, when she realized that Ros was serious about this, that she was fully competent to make this decision herself. But it was a long trip across the Great Plains. It took 4 days. And where they were going, high up in the mountains, it was just a tiny settlement of 25 families or so.
Talk about where they lived.
They lived with a family of homesteaders who had just moved from the valley to the mountains. And so the home, it was a very rudimentary log house, and it wasn't even finished yet. When they walked inside, the front step was a soapbox, and the inside walls weren't up yet. The rooms, such as they were just divided by rugs. And my grandmother said that they reached the second floor, which is where they slept, by a set of shaky and rather ladder-like stairs. And the room was so small, as Rosamond described it, if one of them fell out of bed, she would have rolled right down those stairs.
And it was no heat. They cooked on a wood fire.
It was actually a coal-fired stove in the kitchen, and that provided the only heat in the house. And this was the most brutal winter that anybody had in that whole region had ever remembered. There were blizzards almost every day. The temperature plunged sometimes to 40 degrees below zero. The pitcher in the water on their bureau froze every night.
And in that same period, Dorothy and Rosamond felt very keenly how hard the lives of the little children that they were teaching were.
One of the things that was so interesting to me was to see how quickly they adapted to this life that was unlike anything they had ever even imagined. And when they first got there, it was August. So in the early days of school, it was still warm outside. The children arrived in bare feet, and the two teachers thought this was all charming, their sunburned faces and the raggedy clothes. And within a couple of weeks, they realized that this wasn't picturesque, that these people were desperately poor. And once they realized that and they saw how cold it was going to be, they sent letters home to their parents. And by then, their parents had decided that they were missionaries in the West. And they got their churches together, and just about every week, barrels of clothing arrived for the children and books. And they did it as delicately as they could because they didn't want to offend these people who were very proud. But the fact was the children needed shoes, they needed coats, they needed just about everything.
Your grandmother said, I think, or you said in the book, that the life she had after that year in Colorado was not as easy as she might have expected it to be, and that somehow the Colorado experience prepared her.
It did, and it did for Rosamond, too. Both of them summoned up the experience and the memories of the pioneer women about how they ran the ranches, and they had a very sort of cheerful way of looking at their lives. They always hoped for the best. And I talked about this a little bit with my Aunt Caroline, which is one of the ones to whom the book is dedicated, and about how my grandmother coped. And she said, you know, my mother just grabbed life by the throat and dealt with it. And I don't think she possibly could have done that if she hadn't been out west and watched how these other women dealt with their own difficulties.
Dorothy Wickenden is executive editor of The New Yorker. Her new book about her grandmother's adventures in Colorado's high country is called Nothing Daunted. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much, Linda.